A little bit jittery. A bit of a stress come down. You know, I got a haircut, even though I didn't really need a haircut. I think I just wanted someone to touch my head, you know, soothing.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Sweet Smell of Succession, an unofficial recap podcast about the HBO original series Succession. I'm David Chen, and joining me, as always, she is editor-at-large at primetimer.com and the co-host of the Extra Hot Great podcast, Tara Ariano. Tara, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well and excited to dive into the next episode of Succession. Every week on this podcast, we recap the most recent episode of the HBO hit series. This week, we're going to be talking about Season 2, Episode 7, entitled Return. You can find more episodes of this podcast at successionpodcast.com and email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. Tara, let's just dive straight into this one. Return is the name of the episode. What happens in this episode?
All right. Well, in the aftermath of our Jesties, Shiv has tried to cement her position within the company by writing a great big memo about the way forward for Waystar and is eager to get feedback from Logan. Unfortunately, Logan has already spitefully started icing her out, but he also has a plausible business reason for being unavailable to her. A big shareholders meeting is coming up, and Stewie and Sandy have been barraging major shareholders with negative ads. Jerry also tells Roman that the shareholders want a CEO successor named before the meeting, so if he's serious about the two of them as a dream team, she's going to commission some Oppo research on him to determine where they stand. To secure the family's position, Logan needs to shore up support with a guy named Jack, who owns 4% of the company's voting stock, as well as a 3% shareholder, the kid's mother, Caroline. Conveniently, they both live in England. Inconveniently for Kendall, Logan wants both Roman and Kendall to go with him and bribe Caroline into supporting his leadership. And I really will get into it more as we go on, but Jeremy Strong's acting when he hears he's been forced to return to the scene of the crime is really something. He is, I know you are like less compelled by this episode than I am, I think, but I hope we can agree Jeremy Strong is great.
Yes, I think if Jeremy Strong submits an episode for Emmys, this would be the one. A lot of people were, I read an article actually, this article came out a while ago, but at Decider.com, do you see this this Jeremy Strong article at Decider? It's basically, we'll link to it in the show notes, but it's entitled, Jeremy Strong is Delivering the Best Performance on TV in Succession Season 2 by Jade Budowski. And it basically is just like a love letter to Jeremy Strong's performance. And I mean, she was saying in this article how his performance at the end, when he has that vulnerable moment with Shiv, is worthy of an Emmy. But like this one, I think he really takes it to 11 in this episode. And I think he does a fantastic job. So,
yeah, I agree. I mean, I think he had maybe lulled himself into a false sense of security because it had been so long since Logan brought up what happened in the season one finale.
Yeah.
That he maybe thought it was never going to come up again and he was clear. But then Logan tells him, no, we're going to England and you have to go. And he tries to get out of it, but not very hard because he can't do it. He can't really argue that hard with Logan about anything. So we'll get back to them. In New York, Waystar has hired what Shiv assures Tom is a very friendly legal firm to run the investigation into the malfeasance at Cruises, though Tom is only a few questions into his interview when the lead investigator asks about his knowledge of document destruction, and Tom starts to suspect this isn't going to be the series of softballs he was promised. First, he checks with Shiv that he's not going to be scapegoated on this, and she lies to his face that he's not. Then Tom goes to Greg's and demands the papers Greg saved. Since Greg has also had his interview and is freaked out about it, he's hesitant to give up his insurance policy, but Tom threatens that if Greg doesn't hand the papers over, Tom will tell Logan that Greg has them. So when Greg says the papers are in his office, Tom says he's going to stay over at Greg's that night and go in with Greg the next day to make sure that Greg doesn't get rid of them when they're apart. Now, why doesn't Greg just wait for Tom to fall asleep and then sneak out? This seems obvious to me.
And then like what, go to Kinko's and make copies or something like that?
Yeah, or be like, oh, I thought they were in this drawer, but someone must have gone in and thrown them away. Like just hid them somewhere that Tom didn't know.
Well, I think the answer to that question, Tara, is then in that scenario, we wouldn't get an extremely entertaining scene of Greg trying to get Tom on tape admitting to crimes. Right.
True. Yeah. And we will get to that, too. I mean, I guess the other reason is that the threat of telling Logan. But if Tom doesn't actually have the papers, he doesn't have any proof. Then again, if he doesn't have the papers, then, and he does go to Logan and Greg knows that he did, then Greg can't really use the papers without incriminating himself. So I guess that's the answer. Also, this is frivolous, but this is the first time we've seen Greg's apartment really since Kendall told him he could have it. And it's very nicely decorated. I suppose that maybe Kendall just like had it decorated because he's planning to flip it eventually. But it's I need to know if this is furniture that Greg bought, because if it is, it's very tasteful.
Well, he also has all these people over and one of them says like, welcome to the movement or something. Like, what did you make of that whole gathering at Greg's place? Is he joining like a cult or a multi-level marketing scheme or something? Like,
no, those are just people from Waystar. One of them is Kendall's assistant.
Yeah, but like,
what's her name? Jess? I think they say something like, welcome to the, it's like, it's not the move-in, it's like the next generation or something like that.
Yeah, but what did you
the
think
next was, wave, maybe? Yeah, I the didn't next write wave, it down, something, but something
what,
like that.
What was going on, though, in your opinion?
I just think that they're like the younger people that are in each other's orbits and are happy that all of the old people are away so that they can hang out and maybe leave work sometime before like 9:30 p.m.
Yeah, fair enough.
I didn't think much of it, but I guess we'll see.
I don't know. Between the gathering at Greg's place, Greg's new haircut, he looks quite handsome,
yeah.
I think. He's like dressing more nicely, it seems to me, than he has in the past.
Yep.
And also, he actually lashes out at Tom in this episode.
Yeah.
I feel like Greg is starting to become his own person a little bit. Anyway, mm-hmm. I think that's maybe contributing to that character of Greg mm-hmm. That's emerging before our eyes.
Yes.
But we'll see. We'll see. So.
Yeah, on the fashion tip, I started following Nicholas Braun on Instagram, which I recommend, especially if you enjoy Bachelor or the Bachelor franchise, because he does a lot of Instagram stories about that, which are funny. But he has been really putting up a lot of content during New York Fashion Week. And so that may be the haircut may be a nod to his efforts to be more stylish in his real life. That he was like, I can't walk around with this dumb mid-70s haircut anymore. You got to smarten me up.
Yeah.
Anyway, I agree. It works. He does look good. Greg reluctantly hands over the papers, somewhat cleverly camouflaged in an envelope marked receipts, less cleverly hidden in a folder marked secret. It's not clear how he knows Tom's not going to do anything with them until later, but he has time to go to the men's room at work and, as you said, do a test run of clandestinely recording himself with his phone in his inside breast pocket. That evening, they reconvene on one of their balconies. I couldn't tell whose place they were at, where Tom crumples each piece of paper in a mini fire pit, and Greg tries to narrate the proceedings for his new insurance policy.
Fuck. How did it come to this, huh?
Uh-huh.
How did it come to this?
Right.
What's it?
Right. No one will ever know.
No one will ever know. You sent me to shred the records of off-book hush money and illegal intimidation. Huh? Yeah. Put on the disappearing sauce. Sauce it.
Okay. A little purifying flame. Okay, stand back.
Oh, yeah.
When the lighter won't light, Tom goes inside and get something else to start the fire, permitting Greg to grab back a few pieces of paper and stuff them in his pants. So Tom thinks this is over, but he is wrong.
So a couple things about this sequence. One is I wanted to point out that there's a moment when Tom is ruthlessly mocking Greg, where Greg says like, shut up, or like, F you, or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, like there's a little fire behind his eyes there that may come out in more intense form later. But I thought the stuff with Greg trying to incriminate Tom was pretty funny. Basically, like, his narrative there is what I think whenever I'm watching a cop show and they need to get, they're like, okay, you're going to wear this wire and then you need to get the person to confess. And I'm like, how would I do that? And it's always something very dumb in my mind. Like, all right, so all those crimes we did, huh? Like, pretty intense.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, it seems obvious to me what Greg is doing. Like, it's feel like if anyone were talking to any of us about a criminal conspiracy we were both involved in, like, we would know that's what was going on. But it's funny to me that Tom is still so trusting of Greg, even despite exactly what they are doing, which is covering up the evidence of the last time that Greg double-crossed Tom. Like, Tom still does not make that connection.
Yeah, I mean, Tom just doesn't have very much respect for Greg in general, I think, and that's probably what allows Greg to... Because talking that stupidly is something that Greg would do otherwise, right?
So, true. So yeah. That is true. So the episode is mainly taken up with the trip to England, which Shiv, well on the outside, doesn't hear about until everyone's already gone. Kendall and Roman are both surprised to get on the plane and find Rhea there. Now that she's unemployed, she was already planning a trip to London to see some theater, she says, and her pal Logan offered her a lift. Of course, the real reason Rhea's there is so that Logan can get her opinion about who the next CEO should be, and Rhea's assessment is very candid.
Shiv thinks she's smarter than she is. Roman could actually be good, but nowhere near right now. Kendall's, I don't know. It's like you put him in a big diaper and now he can shit himself whenever he likes. He has all the shots, but he doesn't know when to play them. I don't know.
Watching them suspiciously, Roman wonders aloud if Rhea and Logan are having an affair. And I'm so naive, this never even occurred to me as a possibility. But then I guess Roman knows better than I do what it looks like when Logan is scouting a side piece. I also thought it was funny that Roman calls Logan a rhino like Rhea herself did in Argestes.
Yeah, this is definitely not something I saw coming from from the perspective of the plot, especially because we had just had that episode where kind of Marcia reaffirms her support for Logan. So I'm like, oh, mm-hmm. he's probably gonna stick with her because she's so supportive. And the idea that he, as you said, scout a side piece, I just didn't even see that coming. So
nope.
But the fact if he's going to, the idea that it's Rhea is very plausible to me. Right.
Yeah. Assuming that we've talked before about what it means that Marcia isn't a trophy wife, that in the Turnhaven episode, we were saying that was impressive to Nan that she wasn't. But assuming the characters around the same age as the actors who play them, Marcia is still 15 years younger than Logan is. But even Logan's would be mistresses are not just mere decoration for him. Holly Hunter is even older than I don't know how to pronounce her name, who plays Marcia. Hiam Abbas. Holly Hunter is older than she is. And it's interesting that what attracts Logan is not just natural beauty and an age-appropriate partner, but also that she be talented and refined, and in the case of Rhea, accomplished, although we still don't know what field Marcia was in before she didn't ever have to work again, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's very clear Logan needs to be with someone both in life and sexually who he can respect on an intellectual level, it seems,
mm-hmm. right?
Which is, So
women of substance.
Mm-hmm.
So after his confidential chat with Rhea, Logan calls the boys over so that they can all roast Shiv's tragic memo.
Yeah, I mean, I think the twin quotes from Thomas Aquinas and Amelia Earhart really kick us off with a bang.
Wow, so many pictures. All the smiling children, all the various hues, that melted the heart of even this hardened racist.
I like the spacing of the luxurious.
Mm. It is. But the protein.
Well, there's no shortage of concepts, for sure. It's a rich gumbo of ideas and buzzwords.
Look, we should be gentle. I mean, it's easy to be overly critical of the workings of a major corporation when you have no experience running one. You can't blame her for her lack of experience.
Well, sure you can. Just watch. You'll get the hang of it soon enough.
And if nothing else, we know that if Logan and Rhea end up together, she will fit right in with the Roy tradition of very nasty humor.
Let me just say, Tara, that this scene when they're making fun of Shiv's memo is pretty brutal, just because at the place that I work, writing documents is actually a very valued skill. And people write documents, and at the beginning of meetings, they present documents, and everyone literally sits around reading the documents, and then they talk about the documents.
Yeah.
And this conversation that Logan and Rhea and the guys have is essentially kind of like my mental model of like what people are thinking when one of my documents is being read. So it's rough. And I also like that we never like really see the document or know what the actual text of it is. Like,
right.
It's they just like them talking about it. They're able to convey that, hey, it's hopelessly naive.
Yes.
But as a Shiv stan, I kind of want to say, hey, like, maybe there are some good ideas there, but I don't know what's in it. So I can't, right. I can't really mount a thorough defense.
Well, yeah, when Rhea says that the spacing is luxurious, it's like, oh, that's rough.
Yeah, that is the worst pages. Compliment to get is yeah. You did the margins well in the dog, you know?
Yeah. So in London, things get bad in a hurry. The Roys wake up to find a tabloid newspaper blaming Logan for having bullied someone to death. Not the ATN producer who committed suicide, but Andrew Dodds, the waiter at Shiv's wedding. The theory in the article is that he also died by suicide after Logan fired him. The top team back in New York assure Logan that the Dodds family has no legal grounds on which to come after Logan. Their claim is that Logan punched Dodds, which Logan denies, although we also just saw him deny intentionally striking Roman at Argestes, so he's not necessarily reliable.
Let me just pause there if I can. I mean, I think that we kind of saw the whole Logan-Dodds interaction.
Right.
I agree with you, Logan's not reliable, but I think we saw the whole interaction and he didn't strike Dodd. So I do think we are meant to believe that his family is lying.
I don't think that they're lying. I think that someone else told them that.
They weren't
there.
I see. Oh, yeah. No.
Someone else reported it.
Good point.
But
yeah.
Right. So my point is that you're right. We never saw him punch Andrew Dodds and we have no reason to think that he did. But it's not outlandish that someone would claim that because presumably someone at the wedding has seen Logan do something like that in the past.
Sure.
That's all. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
So Kendall feebly says that the report is incorrect, but doesn't volunteer any of the clarifying details that we know, meaning how Kendall himself was implicated, obviously. Jerry says the family really just wants an apology, which Logan flatly refuses, but he backs down when he hears that the tabloid that interviewed Dodd's parents is one of Sandy's. After the call, we learn that Naomi Pierce, who opened the episode by successfully soliciting a dick pic from Kendall, not that we see it. We demand penis parody on all shows, HBO, not just the Righteous Gemstones. Anyway, Naomi flew in from the Venice Biennale to see Kendall. Logan gets rid of her and briefs Roman and Kendall about what they may say to Caroline. They can't exactly just offer her a cash payout since it will look too much like a bribe. But Logan can reopen the divorce settlement, which amounts to the same thing. They can offer $10 million, knowing Logan will go as high as $50 million. When he says that they can all split whatever the difference is between what she accepts and Logan's ceiling, Roman cracks that it'll pay for therapy, and Logan takes it back.
I think the thought that comes to mind here is, it is curious to me, when you're at a later stage in life, as some of these characters are, and you're really, really rich, you're obscenely wealthy, I am just curious, like, what is it, like, what does a 10 or 15, $50 million thing, like, what difference does that really make? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what is the marginal utility of $50 million to these people who basically can have whatever they want? It just doesn't, I'm always just curious, you know, I may never understand what the drive to get that is. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. But,
yeah.
Yeah, I don't either. And when you hear these numbers thrown around, you it's hard not to think like this is the same as if they were talking about like $100 or $500. Like,
right.
It's nothing. It's nothing to them.
Yeah. So it's like, obviously their mom has like other intentions and needs, you know, but it does seem like in different circumstances like that, this, you know, $10 or $50 million thing would have worked. And so, I'm just kind of like, oh, really? Like you weren't willing to support him, but like for an extra $20 million you were? Like, it just doesn't make much sense to me. But anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
So when Roman has left, Kendall tries to pump Logan for information about what went on with Rhea the night before. Logan accuses Kendall of being the one who's making poor decisions out of lust, though he uses a saltier term for that, which I will not repeat, and then announces that actually he thinks Kendall should come with him to talk to the Dodds family. And I don't get how the Kendall who was shitting his pants the previous day about returning to England now feels secure enough to try to caution his father about the possibility that Rhea is playing him.
Yeah, I mean, that was a little bit of a stretch, but I mean, I think this episode is weird overall. Like, that moment is weird. Why does Logan invite Kendall to go with him? You know, that's my big question is, like, why does Kendall say, like, hey, you should come with me to this thing? Is it for the moral support? Does Logan need moral support from Kendall? It just it felt a little weird to me, you know? Agreed, Kendall's kind of right on the knife's edge with regards to how much he's willing to stand up to his dad. And I mean, we just don't know how sensitive Logan is about these matters of the heart. But I think what is clear, though, that kind of makes it okay, I think, in my mind, Kendall questioning his father's actions is like that he's trying to protect the company, right? He's
right.
not just being like, hey, you shouldn't be doing that because it's immoral. He's saying like, hey, is this the best thing for the company? And I think even though Logan is an asshole, maybe on some level he can see that. I don't know.
Oh, I definitely don't think that Kendall is questioning him on moral grounds at all.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, like, Logan doesn't like to get pushed back on anything at all. So I think that it was just weird to me that Kendall thought, oh, this is where I'm going to overstep, you know?
Yeah.
But but to answer your question, overall, I don't think that Logan has Kendall come with him for moral support. That seemed clear to me that it was emotional manipulation, that he was trying to control Kendall by saying like,
yeah.
I know this thing about you. You don't, you are going to sit in this kitchen and not know if I'm going to be in that living room telling this guy's family what really happened.
Yeah.
You know,
like it's another way of exercising control over Kendall.
Completely. Right? Yeah.
In a really brutal fashion, but yeah.
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 So Shiv is flown in at her mother's request, and though Shiv misses Logan at the Roy townhouse, Rhea, who the night before had offered to handle the Shiv situation for Logan, invites Shiv out for lunch in some extremely deft emotional manipulation. First, Rhea lets it be known that she's interested in having an affair with Logan, flattering Shiv by making it seem like doing so is contingent on Shiv's sign-off, which Shiv, a bit flustered, grants. It helps that Shiv's not that fond of Marcia and therefore doesn't really care if Logan betrays her. Then Rhea suggests that in order to cement her position in Waystar's order of succession, Shiv needs to force the issue by letting Logan know she has other offers, like maybe CEO of Pierce, since they now have a vacancy. Rhea can convey Shiv's interest. Wow, how generous and selfless of her.
Did you understand at this point of the episode what game Rhea was playing?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Because
yeah,
she, 100%. I mean, she does like hint at it the previous night, like, hey, I'm going to like take this... you know, eliminate the Shiv problem for you, right?
Right.
But I didn't know, like, I understood, like that Rhea was being underhanded in some way, but I thought that the way she was being underhanded was literally that she would get Shiv the job, and not that it would just be, like, a way to drive a wedge between her and Logan, if that makes sense.
Oh,
yeah.
No, I knew where this was headed. I mean, right. we'll get to it, but yes.
Well, as a far more experienced television watcher, that makes complete sense to me that you would already be there, but yes.
I mean, maybe I'm just more experienced in women undermining each other. Not to sell out the sisterhood, but you know, such things do happen. Anyway, Logan and Kendall journey to the waiter's parents' house, where they're met by, presumably, a UK-based Waystar media flack and a photographer to capture Logan's condolence visit. Logan suggests that Kendall come inside with him, but then meets with the waiter's survivors alone, leaving Kendall to torture himself by looking at photos of his manslaughter victim. When Dodd's Uncle Paul bustles in to make tea, Kendall will only accept a glass of water. Then he washes the glass.
So many amazing touches about this whole sequence, like him mm-hmm. washing the glass is a really nice touch, because the entire time we've seen Kendall in this whole series, he has been taken care of by wait staff or by
yep.
you know, help and whatever, and so you never really see him washing his own dishes.
Oh Lord, no.
But he does in these people's house, and then there's an amazing shot when Kendall's leaving the house. A lot of shallow depth of field in this episode overall, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where the background is very blurry. The show's yep. general style, from my perspective, is not to use shallow depth of field.
Mm-hmm.
It's generally like you have like a shot with multiple people inside it, or it's very documentary style, like, oh, where the camera is just barely catching up, or they're going to use a wide angle so that you can see lots of people interacting, because so much of the show is people like interacting, bouncing off of each other, potentially improvising.
Yeah.
And so when the show really does use shallow depth of field, you're focusing on one person, everything else is blurred out, as the shot is when Kendall leaves the house. It really is, in my opinion, a break in the style of the show. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's used very effectively here, because Kendall, you want to be in Kendall's mindset as he's leaving that house, and and understand how intense it is and how painful it is for him. So,
yeah, it really conveys that feeling of when something terrible happens to you and you sort of like are almost outside yourself watching yourself and thinking this is so awful, whatever it is. It doesn't feel real.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's that's how those shots made me feel. So yeah, good call calling that out. But yeah, as we already said, I assume this will be Jeremy Strong's Emmy submission episode next year. But having watched Adam McKay, who is the pilot director and an EP on the show, talking about how much improvisation there is when they shoot, he was in a roundtable on Close Up with Hollywood Reporter. Great show on the Sundance Network if you don't watch it. But I would love to know whether washing the glass was in the script or if it was Jeremy Strong's idea. Because the example that he used on that episode of Close Up with a Hollywood Reporter was in the pilot when Kendall is so angry he goes crazy in the bathroom. And he was saying that that was all improv. Like they had two camera operators in the room and they were just like, just go nuts, do everything. And, you know, I think everyone who watches the show remembers that episode, especially that it ends with him after he's like broken Q-tips in half and like smashed a thing of potpourri and screamed into a towel. Then he like gets down on his knees and starts cleaning it up. Like, that's what I just wonder about the glass. Like if that was his idea to be like, how can Kendall make himself as unobtrusive in this house as possible? He will take a glass of water, but then he washes the glass. It's like he was never here.
Yeah. Yeah. And I read an interview with Jeremy Strong not too long ago. And, you know, the interviewer asked him like, well, you're in such a intense dark mind space, like what are some tricks or some tactics that you used to get there? And he was very kind of simple about it. He's just like, I just got myself in the mindset, like, you know, I got myself in the mindset of somebody who had murdered this person and is like suffering under his father's foot, and it wouldn't surprise me if the people who made this episode really took Jeremy Strong, put him in this kitchen, and we're just like, what would you do if you were in this kitchen, you know? And yeah, the way he plays it is brilliant. So
mm-hmm. That's my favorite moment of the episode. I just think it's so smartly observed and so small that I wanted to call it out and specifically talk about it.
It's great. Yeah.
So when Logan emerges ready to go, Kendall hesitantly asks whether Logan thinks Kendall should say something to Dodd's family. Logan does not. And in the car, a hearty Logan assesses the waiter's survivors.
Poor bastards. They've been through the ringer, you know. Fuck knows how they cope. They were embarrassed, really. They knew he was a druggie. Yeah, that is life. Don't forget it. Right? You know, there's nothing to be ashamed of. Our stuff. We give them a bit of a laugh, some decent TV to watch, news that doesn't talk down to them. Good fucking people, nice fucking folk.
And it's so hard to know with Logan how much he can, to quote Howard's End, only connect his experience with those of other people. I honestly can't tell if the purpose of this speech is to needle Kendall or if he really just can't see the parallels between himself and people whose circumstances are so much more modest than his own and is just talking to talk. Well, what did you think?
I mean, I think that you get a lot of shots of Logan in the car with his children this episode. And mm-hmm. There's him with Roman earlier where they have this awkward conversation about him hitting Roman last time. And, oh, I didn't mean to hit you. I would never do anything like that, you know. And I think that there is a lot of self-denial, right, with Logan. I think, like, I think Logan does know he hit Roman. I think he knows he intended to hit Roman. But that there's this image of himself he needs to convey to his children. And that's what we're seeing in this scene as well, is it's not necessarily obliviousness. It's more, I think of it more as self-denial. I think he knows what's up and he just like can't acknowledge it.
Right.
So, yeah.
Mm. But I also don't know why the two halves of this, the clip that we just heard are together. Why his pity for the Dodds family immediately takes this left turn to Logan's self-aggrandizing assessment of how proud he should be of like the various kinds of content his companies create for people like the Dodds.
I mean, if I'm the channel Logan, it's just like he rarely interacts with people like the Dodds. And so when he does interact with them, he sees them not necessarily as human beings, but as potential consumers.
Right.
And so I think that's what we're seeing reflected in that part of the scene.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So then it's time for Roman and Shiv to go endure their mother's famously terrible cooking, and she doesn't disappoint with a meal of pigeon, which she warns is still full of shot and possibly feathers. I loved how we see Shiv and Roman preemptively shopping for snacks to sustain them when they decline Caroline's inedible meal without even knowing what it is. This is apparently the place they always go on their way to her house to buy whatever food they're going to really eat.
Here's my question, Tara. If you're in a gas station or convenience store in the middle of nowhere, what would your go-to snack be? Because I did appreciate Shiv's logic of, hey, like, I'm going to buy a banana because, like, nothing can really be wrong with a banana.
Right.
Do you have, like, a go-to gas station snack that you like?
I'm with her on bananas. They come in their own wrapper, so you don't need to worry that they've been, like, sprayed with something weird that you're going to eat. If you're going to buy fruit in a gas station, banana is your, that's your guy. But I, to be honest, I would probably have several courses. I would probably get something salty, so like a Dorito, something in the chip family. And then probably something like I enjoy a Welch's fruit snack. That's usually what I get when I have a plane ride, or like M&M's, something like that. What about you?
Yeah, I think the thing is, in that case, like, processed food is your friend, because even though it's not healthy, you know, they have designed and replicated it such that they know it can be eaten in environments like that.
Yeah.
So it'd be hard to eat healthily in that situation, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say banana safe, and also probably like pop chips or something. Yeah, as you put it, in the chip family. but in terms of a healthy thing, that would be tough. Like it is always a risk of like getting hot food, like getting like a chicken sandwich or hot dog or something. You just never know how long that stuff has been there.
Right. I mean, an American gas station or convenience store, you could get like a Clif Bar or like a Kind Bar, maybe. That's like, you know, it's still basically a chocolate bar, but like it's a little bit better for you, kind of.
I think a Kind Bar is like relatively healthy, you know, when it comes to it's basically just nuts held together with some honey. So, yeah, I think I would say, yeah, Kind Bar, like I would probably do Kind Bar, RX Bar, another good bar there. Uh-huh. So yeah, that's probably the totality of what I would do. Not things that the Roys eat, though. So
no, I mean, I would just add before we move on from this topic, which thank you for bringing up because it's very important.
Agreed.
you just do not know what you're gonna get in a British convenience store. Like the stuff that they eat as snacks are wild, like prawn chips.
Hey, I mean, that is also a Chinese chips. Convenience store, you know, prawn chips. I'm a fan of those.
Oh, but, okay. Sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. I understand they're alienating to people, but yes.
Then you'll be all set.
What else? What other things are crazy that you have found?
I don't know. I mean, I just know that like their chip flavors are very weird. They'll be like really malty vinegar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Or gravy, like beef gravy.
Yeah. No, that's true. It's true.
Anyway, enough about snacks. Caroline knows quite well why Shiv and Roman are there. Shiv tries to use her official outsider status at the company to weasel out of responsibility for this too, but it doesn't really work. Roman opens the bidding at $10 million, but claims Logan's ceiling is $40 million. Caroline knows that means $50 million, though Shiv states that Logan would never tell Roman what his actual ceiling is and is probably right. Caroline has counteroffers already. She will take the Summer Palace. She cheerfully confirms that she doesn't like the house, but knows that Logan loves it and won't want to give it up. Her real counteroffer, however, is $20 million and Christmases with the kids. Shiv claims this wouldn't be punitive for her, but no one really believes it. Caroline straight up says they're going to make Logan choose whether he'd rather keep his Hamptons house or holidays with his children, and he either doesn't know or doesn't care how much it will make said children feel when, as they all know he will, he chooses real estate over family.
Only thing I just want to point out here, Tara, is that they do acknowledge that like the Summer Palace is worth way more than Logan's ceiling, right? It was like $150 million or something like that, which is pretty intense. I also thought that Shiv saying like, hey, Roman doesn't know what the actual number is, was like smart maneuvering on her part.
Yeah.
Because it kind of takes the pressure off of Roman and potentially allows them to get it does allow them to get a better deal, I think, than they would have otherwise. So.
Yeah, true. So Kendall gets out of dinner with his mother by claiming he's going to the pub. In reality, he takes a cab back to the Dodds house and shoves a small wad of bills through the mail slot. When he returns to Caroline's house, she's awake and he's desperate to confess.
Do you think maybe we can talk?
Sure, absolutely. Go ahead, but, but are they quite difficult things? Because, you know, a bit tired for home truths.
Right. Well, yeah, it's a bit difficult.
Okay. Mm-mm. Well, go on.
It's fine.
No, I want to. Come on.
It's okay.
No, if you want, we can absolutely do it now, but, you know, it might be better to do it over an egg.
Sure. Uh-huh. Let's do it over an egg.
Yeah. We'll feel better in the morning, and we can do it tomorrow. Okay. Sleep tight, sweet boy.
But in the morning, there is no egg. Caroline has left a breezy note to let her children know she's more interested in doing errands than she is in saying goodbye. And seeing in such stark terms that Kendall has no safe harbor, even in his own family, is so hard to watch.
I agree. I think the primary function of this episode is to show how terrible both Roy parents are, right?
Yeah.
And as a result, you kind of get a sense of why the kids might have turned out this way. Mm-hmm. You get a sense of Caroline in last season, right, when she's at the wedding and she's not a nice person, right?
Yeah.
But I don't think you understand the true depth of her neglect until this scene. Also, the scene when Kendall goes and walks back to the Dodds house kind of visually feels like a mirror of the season one finale when he's walking back home in the cold from the car accident, and he's kind of like, you know, on the street by himself and huddled because it's cold and raining and he's in the dark, and you don't see Logan walking in the dark that much on the show, and that's the only other time you've seen it. I'm sorry, Kendall, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little heartbreaking. Any guesses as to how much money was in there, by the way?
Oh, man. I mean, I assume they were hundreds.
Yeah, it looked like a 100, like a pile of hundreds that was like 100 bills. So probably
sounds right.
10,000 pounds or so, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Which is like not that much, but I guess he felt like he couldn't drop more without it being like noticed or more suspicious or what have you.
Well, I mean, it's not like they're not going to know where it's from.
Really?
Right.
I don't know.
Who else would they think would leave 10,000 pounds in their mail slot?
I don't know. Cause I guess the reason that I don't think they would think it's the Roys is because things have been so contentious with the Roys, you know? Like if I was threatening to like take down a rich dude and then he came to the house to apologize and then like later, I guess you're right. Now that I play out the sequence of events like that, I think you're probably right that maybe that's the Roys are the most plausible explanation. So
yeah. The other thing we don't know is if Logan gave them cash when he was there as well, you know, because we know that that's their move since the series premiere, like the way
the
they
yellow
get out
envelope,
of
right? Yeah.
Right. A fat envelope. So, you know, it may just be like Kendall thinking, okay, my dad probably paid them off, but even if he did, I have to also because it was my fault. But yeah, I think when a billionaire is at your house in the afternoon and you wake up the next morning and there's a bunch of cash in your mail slot, you have to connect the two.
Fair enough. Fair enough, Tara.
And the other thing that we don't know in terms of contention is that, you know, because it was Sandy's outlet, if they sent a reporter that was going to like goad them into giving the quotes that they would want to make Logan look as bad as possible.
Mm.
Because, you know, Jerry says what all they really want is an apology. Right.
Yeah.
And they do seem satisfied by that as far as we know. So Shiv finally tracks Logan down at his breakfast table where there is evidence that he dined with someone, though Rhea isn't there, and tries to get his feedback on the memo, which he claims he didn't read. She knows this is a lie, Roman having already told her how they all read it / made fun of it on the plane ride over. Shiv then overplays her hand, demanding to know if she's still Logan's pick to be the next CEO. This is a tactical error on her part.
You know that I want this and that I can do it.
Then why are you fucking me about?
As in?
Putting your name in for the Pierce job. Talking to those backstabbers, huh? What's that all about? If you're going to be coming in here talking a whole load of crap to your father.
Who told you?
Who told me? It's all over town. Nan Pierce is shouting it like a war trophy in the city.
Okay, well, you know what? I had to keep my options open, Dad.
Oh, yeah, I see. Because we have a little fallout or something? We're a family. We can have our bumps. I don't expect that.
Well, it's not that I was...
Family, Siobhan! If you don't understand that, then fuck off.
So the most decisive evidence that Shiv isn't ready to be CEO of anything is that she fell into Rhea's obvious trap.
So,
I think.
Yeah, I mean, definitely she lost the Game of Thrones, at least temporarily, right? But... Was it me, or did this whole subplot just felt kind of like nonsense to me? I mean, the idea here is that Rhea's like, I'm going to get rid of Shiv, and how she does that is by offering her the opportunity to get floated as CEO of Pierce, an opportunity that Shiv takes so that Logan can then accuse her of looking elsewhere for a job, and then that way he has justification to shut Shiv out. Is that the sequence of events? Because it just feels to me like Logan doesn't need any justification to do anything. He'd just be like, hey, Shiv, like, guess what? I changed my mind. You know, and that would be a completely, if not reasonable, then certainly predictable series of events that Shiv would be forced to accept. You know, it felt like this whole song and dance for nothing. But what do you think?
Well, I agree with you. He does not need the excuse, but he didn't ask Rhea to do it. Rhea offered. And so this may be like, this is Rhea's love language.
It's emotional manipulation, right?
You know? Yeah. Like, she offered to do it both as a gift to him, like out of love or whatever it is between them, and also to show off how she could trick Shiv, whose whole thing is how smart she is, into acting against her own interests, but also to best Shiv, who she clearly thinks is her biggest rival for CEO of Waystar, I think.
That's
my
read. That's fair enough. This is the sixth love language,
right.
I think, right? Is tricking your lover's daughter into thinking that she has a job and then using her eagerness to accept that offer as a way to stab her in the back, I think is...
I mean, it's a gift and it's an act of service. So I think those are both love languages we all know.
Agreed.
Yeah. So as Rhea and the male Roys wait for their plane to depart, Logan tells Rhea that he might want to get his list of CEO candidates down to just two or three. And Rhea would be pleased to offer her input. In a car on her way to her own plane home, and God forbid she's so far out in the cold that she has to fly commercial, Shiv calls Kendall with a warning. He needs to watch out for Rhea. That's
all
it.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole episode. So overall, what did you think of this episode, Tara?
I mean, I thought it was effective, but I also think this was a lot of plot motion to set things up as we move toward the finale. After this, we only have, as far as I know, three episodes to go.
Yeah.
So I do think it was effective in terms of the stuff we already said, how good Jeremy Strong was and stuff. But I do think that it was a lot. It was very plotty for what we're used to.
I would actually argue differently. I would argue it has some of the least amount of plot.
Really?
Episode. Yeah, I just felt like this was very much a character study of these characters, right? Like, because I feel like in the other episodes, like, so much is happening. Like, you know, there's that scene a couple episodes ago where Rhea says, like, hey, you know, Nan would like to meet with these people. Don't worry about it. It's just life or death. You know, like, it's like super high stakes, all these powerful people everywhere. This time it's just, hey, we're going to go visit mom and, like, kind of untangle a few things about our personal lives. So, like, to me, it felt like very non-plot driven, very, like, much of a character study. Very, like, hey, we're going to learn more about Kendall, what drives him. We're going to learn more about the relationship between these kids and their mom. Like, and then this whole thing about Logan, right? Like, I just didn't feel like there were any stakes there, because I felt like Logan doesn't need to... Logan doesn't need to pull a Truman Show on Shiv to, like, you know, get out of the offer to Shiv that, you know what I mean? Like, he can just be like, hey, guess what? You're not it anymore. I mean, that's what Shiv thought would happen anyway. So why does, like, now when they tell that story at Christmas, like, you know, Logan can make it so that Shiv's the bad guy? Like, it just doesn't seem like something Logan would care about. So this is probably my least favorite episode of the season so far. It's not bad because, as you've already said, we've already discussed, like, Kendall, a.k.a. Jeremy Strong, is awesome. And it's always fun to see Greg and Tom hijinks. But I think you're right that it is just kind of moving the pieces into place for what I'm hoping will be a very eventful final three episodes.
Yeah, so. I figure this is like, this is kind of by taking up time before the final kind of mini arc of the season.
Yeah, it reminds me of like season one, episode eight in some ways. Mm-hmm. Like it feels like this show's version of a bottle episode almost, because like a lot of the locations are just like interiors with only a few characters, whereas if you notice, you go back like the last few episodes, it's like they're going to these like massive conferences or these big confabs with like dozens and dozens of people, right?
Yeah.
And this is just like, you know, only like, I don't know, seven or eight speaking roles total or whatever. And and so it felt like this version, like even with a bottle episode, the show is still extremely decadent, right? Like these are amazing, beautiful locations. But it's much fewer actors than usual and very much focused on the emotions. And I think like the main kind of emotional crux of like Shiv realizing she's being backstabbed just didn't play for me. And that's why it's one of my least favorite of the season so far. But yeah, some value there still. So
yeah.
Those are our overall thoughts on this week's episode. Every week on The Sweet Smell of Succession, we like to choose winners and losers. We pick a winning Roy and a losing Roy, as well as a winning non-Roy and a losing non-Roy. Tara Ariano, who is your winning Roy of the episode?
Logan, coming back from losing Roy last time. He gets everything he wants. He gets a cute new hummingbird girlfriend. He gets Shiv shoved out of the way. He gets a very easy settlement with his ex-wife to get her support back before the shareholder meeting. She even offers, we didn't say this part, but she offers to talk to the other guy and get him on side to Jack, the other guy that Logan came to pitch. And yeah, everything's coming up Logan this week. He's far ahead of everyone else.
Agreed. I think Logan is the winning Roy this episode as well. Losing Roy of the episode. Who's your losing Roy of this week's episode?
Well, my losing Roy is Kendall, not in the Game of Thrones sense, but emotionally, where he has to revisit what I assume, God, I hope it's the worst moment of his life, being complicit in the death of another human being. But also finding out that, you know, even if he had not counted on his father to be a safe person to like offer him emotional support in the aftermath of this, because he's the only person he knows, then trying to confide in his mother and her basically being like, I can't do this emotional labor for you as your mother. It's rough.
Yeah, I think Kendall's a great choice for losing Roy of the episode. I would say actually Shiv is my losing Roy of the episode.
I mean, sure.
Because she is, you know, brutally mocked by her family for her memorandum, which. I just like, oh man, like I bet those guys are being unfair to that memorandum, Tara, but whatever. I don't know. I don't have the text in front of me, okay? But yes, they were mocking her, and that's just tough. But then she finally has it out with Logan and finds that nope, all that stuff that happened in season two, episode one, it was fake. It was headed towards this point in time, which we all probably saw coming. It was like a train that was coming from far away, and you knew it was going to arrive at the station at some point. You just didn't know when. This is the episode when it arrived. So, yeah. Shiv is my losing Roy of the episode.
That
winning non-Roy. Who's your winning non-Roy of the episode?
Rhea. She helped Logan to get to where he wanted to go, and in doing so got to where she wanted to go and is really sitting pretty at this point.
I agree. She definitely is a master manipulator and has played all of her cards correctly so far. But she has now garnered the attention of Shiv, like the negative attention of Shiv. And I'm actually excited to see them go at each other. Like, I think they both can be pretty formidable. So we'll see how that plays out. I am curious, though. This episode never explicitly acknowledges that they slept together. Am I right about that? Like,
you're correct.
It's heavily implied, but you know, you don't like it. Doesn't actually show it or it doesn't even show like Rhea like waking up next to him. I'm curious if you feel like there's a reason for that. Like, is, you know, like I'm just wondering why wouldn't, like, there's that scene when Roman kind of eggs Kendall on and it's like, yeah, go inside. There's no problem with going inside, you know? And Kendall opens the door and Rhea's not there. And like, I'm wondering, like, why wasn't Rhea there? Like, what is the plot function of not showing Rhea there? You know, or is it like a tone thing? Like, it would be weird to see Rhea there, and like, I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
Well, if part of her game is to flatter Shiv at that lunch into saying, "I'm thinking of starting something up with your dad. Would that be okay with you?" Then she has to have plausible deniability that anything has happened already, right? But I also think it's possible they haven't slept together yet. They when Shiv comes to see Logan the next morning, when he's away from all of the rest of them when they're at Caroline's, because he's out with this Jack guy pitching him, and then he had said he was going to probably have dinner with Rhea after. And then, as I said, we see remnants of someone else having eaten at the breakfast table with him, and but she's not there. It's possible they haven't slept together yet.
Yeah.
That she's still playing out the string. But, you know, why wouldn't they show them together? I don't know. They hardly ever show people in bed together on the show, to be honest.
They did a few times with Shiv and Nate, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
In season one.
But we didn't see Kendall and Naomi together either, and we presume that they slept together.
Yeah, we did see Kendall have sex with his ex-wife in season one.
Right.
But yeah, it just is like, I wonder what's going on. Like, I think you're right. Maybe we'll find out that they never slept together, right? And like, Logan just doesn't roll that way.
Right.
And that this is all just a huge misdirect. But I do think it is significant that they didn't show her, you know, in that situation.
Yeah.
So I'll be curious to see how that plays out. Anyway, so Rhea is our winning non-Roy of the episode. And finally, losing non-Roy of the episode. Tara, who's your losing non-Roy?
Man, this was hard because, as you already said, there's so many fewer characters in this episode than what we normally get.
Yeah.
But I went with Jerry because if she was serious about trying to position Roman as CEO successor, it seems like she has been outmaneuvered by Rhea as well, without Rhea even knowing that Jerry was in the running in any sense.
Yeah. Agreed. Well, I think that's a great choice for losing non-Roy. I think the show is setting up Jerry and Roman to like team up and be like another force that's going to vie for the throne, right? I think we're going to see like it's now like almost like a fully fledged like four horse race between Rhea, Shiv, Kendall, and then Roman and Jerry. Like, those are all four very plausible successors, in my opinion. And that excites me that they're like gearing up and like it's all very plausible. But for me, the losing non-Roy this week would be Andrew Dodd's family, because they were apparently satisfied by whatever the hell Logan gave them, like just an apology, and continue to remain in the dark about the true nature of their son's death. And so that's a pretty dark losing non-Roy reason, but I think that they are the true losers in this whole scenario. They have are yet another family that's been screwed out of what they deserve by people in a far better societal position than them. So for that reason, Andrew Dodd's family is my losing Roy of the week. Every week on this podcast, we also like to choose a quote of the week. Tara, what is your quote of the week?
I forgot when we were doing our doc to go back and give the exact quote, but my recollection is that once again, it's a line from Roman. He is needling Shiv about whether she's prepared to take over the company, and tells her in a very sarcastic way, you know, "Have you ever heard of it? It's called Waystar, Royco. We do hate speech and roller coasters," which I thought was very good.
That is pretty good. I have actually a couple. One of them is when Rhea and Logan are speaking about the future of the company, and she says, quote, "The next Zuckerfucker comes along and swallows you up, shits you out as an app, end quote. I think that is a pretty bleak view of the tech industry's interaction with the media industry these days, but well put, as usual, for characters on the show.
Yep.
And I don't have the exact quote for this one, but there was this interaction that Logan had about his helicopter pilot,
Oh yeah.
Where he's talking about his helicopter pilot Surge, and he's like, I don't want Surge to fly me around. Like, I want an old ass, boring ass guy to fly me around. Surge, when I talk to Surge, it always seems like his dick's wet, and he's about to offer me some Pinot. He says something like that, and it's like, I just think like, whoa, what a random assortment of characteristics for Surge, this character that I don't think we even know.
No.
Maybe it's the one that Logan yelled at a couple episodes ago about, like, fly your whirly bird.
Drive yeah. your fucking whirly bird.
Yeah. But I just think that's what a lovely touch of, like, you know, there are some times when I watch something and I think to myself, you know, like, in a very kind of joking and somewhat self-effacing fashion, almost like, yeah, you know, I bet if I worked really hard, I could write something like this one day, decades in the future. Mm-hmm. But then when I hear him say something like this comment about Surge and like he offers me Pinot and his dick's wet, I'm like, I don't even know how I could ever have come up with that pair of things. You know, like, if I'm describing someone, I don't know that I would come up with those two things to describe them. And it's just another testament to the brilliant writers of the show. So
indeed, even in an episode that you thought was mostly only okay.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely correct. So anyway, that's our conversation about season 2, episode 7. Hope you enjoyed it. You can find more episodes of this podcast at successionpodcast.com. Email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. And this podcast was powered by Simplecast. If you're looking to start your own podcast, check out simplecast.com. They have some great resources and features for you, for anyone who is starting their own podcast. I think they're great, and they are the engine that powers the sweet smell of Succession. Until next week, Tara Ariana, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
People can listen to me every Wednesday at the Extra Hot Grape podcast. That's at extrahotgrape.com. And you can find me promoting my various ventures at my Twitter feed, which is Tara Ariano, TaraArianO.
Find me on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, SKY. And check out my other podcast, Culturally Relevant, which you can find at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.